Just think about what the federal restricted zone looks like and all of the various bases and all the various different operations around Washington, D.C. that operate together with aviation. How do you include drones into all of that and make it safe, secure, and the data is exchanging between all of them and nobody's capable of hacking into it and causing a problem? So these are the things that we're starting to articulate for the federal government.
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host John Ramstad takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
All right, welcome to Hangar X Studios, and this is where the innovators, the executives, the investors in aerospace come to get the information before the rest of us because they're making real-world important decisions as we scale and grow, and we are hitting an inflection point. And today we have a great episode today with Chris Hewlett. First of all, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Very much appreciate being with you guys.
Now, and if you guys are listening and you want to understand how drones are really working and are going to work inside of the national airspace, we have to first look at what the Department of War is now doing. And Chris Hewlett, you are right at the center of that, and you are the man, and you are also in charge of something called Project Ultra, which we're also going to be talking about. So a couple key things is for everybody listening. First of all, what is the DOW doing for real UAS integration, and what is the implications that this has for BV loss missions as Part 108 gets adopted here, both commercially and in the military and for law enforcement? We're also going to be talking about how Project Ultra, that you're in charge of, has gone from simulations to real-world cargo logistics missions, and you're gathering data, you're flying real aircraft, you're pushing the boundaries. And then also, why does data and airspace and integration, that whole layer, why is it so important? In my opinion, this is an enabling set of capabilities and skills that we need to actually harness what drones can do for us in the future. So, you know, as we kick this off, Chris, let me I got to read your bio because it's awesome. We were just catching up. We were both Navy guys, so you were throwing out about 100 acronyms, and I was I was clocking you at real speed. It was awesome. But you are the director of Project Ultra. It's at Grand Sky up in North Dakota. Retired Navy commander, 30 years of experience in aviation operations. How many H-60 or helicopter hours do you have? 3,000 plus, I'm sure.
Yeah, just shy of 3,000, so 2,700. But yeah, so I rolled it up. Right? So my favorite part was when I was working on the joint staff, I worked for a general. I'm not going to mention his name because he'll see this at some point and then find me. But when I was on my check-in brief, and this is when we could wear flight suits on the joint staff back in the day, and I had my patch on, you know, 2,000 hours, right, at the time, and because I was a young 04. And he had on a 1,500 hour patch. I'm not kidding. You had a 1,500 hour Sikorsky patch on. And I was kind of looking at it and he said, "Are you eyeballing something, Huey?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am. Where'd you get the halfway to cool kid patch?" And he got so mad. He told me he had a lot more time in Little Birds and other things. And I'm like, "Hey, sir, whatever gets you to sleep at night."
Oh, that's funny. Well, let's talk. You're the director of Project Ultra. Here's what it stands for: Unmanned Logistics, Traffic Research, and Autonomy. This is a multi.
It's that? Actually the R. Sorry, the R. A lot of people confuse it. The R is actually response. That's our counter UAS side of the house.
Okay, love that. Multi-year DOW backed initiative. It's to ensure scalable drone operations in the national airspace system. And under your leadership, you're advancing this into real world BV loss operations, cargo, military. And you're also building that data and infrastructure layer that's really going to be a model, which I think is great. Safe integration of uncrewed aircraft into what has long been traditional aviation. So let's start maybe with this question. I think that kind of frames this up is, you know, the industry has been kind of stuck in a lot of piloting and testing programs. And Project Ultra is the first one I think that has really moved this from simulation to real-world operations. So what was the thinking, the concept that allowed you to move it into real-world repeatable operations?
Yeah, no, so great question, John. So when we started putting this together for the Department of War in partnership with our team in Grand Forks, there's a real appetite, especially in Grand Forks County, to start lending its aviation background, its proud aviation background, its relationship with the University of North Dakota and probably one of the largest flight schools in the world, and the team that's up there, and remarkably, the congressional representation, Senator John Hoeven. This is really an initiative that a lot of people started putting together and engaging with myself and some of the other partners involved in this. And we formed a team and conceptually started having conversations with the Undersecretary of War, for Acquisitions and Sustainment, which really owns this process. And when we started talking about this, we started talking about what a difference maker could be to apply operational test and evaluation concepts to what has traditionally been more research, development, and evaluation side of the house. So it's how do we create a microcosm that exists where the Department of War can bring real-world applications that are at a much higher maturation level and a higher technical readiness level to actually implement and put them into the airspace and then test and evaluate their interoperability. The original underpinnings of Project Altair were really about airspace integration, specifically when it came to the traffic management side of the house, right? So the early stages of that simulation work that we did was really to validate some of the early growth around the federal UAS service suppliers that had been built over the last 10 years in partnership with MITRE and NASA and the Federal Aviation Administration and Air Force Research Lab. So one of the two first things that we tested and evaluated were the FREDI system from NASA, which is their UTM system, and the CLUE system from AFRL. And so we're still working diligently with CLUE.
Is that a UTM system also?
It's so they don't call it UTM. In fact, we're trying to stay away from, in our vernacular, UAS transportation management because it means everything and nothing all at once, right? So it's just traffic management.
Okay.
Right? So advanced traffic management. So that's the ATM or advanced aerial mobility side of the house. So at its underpinnings, this was all about integrating airspace. And once we set up the operational construct and realized that part of our team is the Northern Plains UAS test site, right, which is one of the FAA facilities that allows for operational test of unmanned systems. And so they possess the necessary airworthiness and certificates of authorization and airworthiness waivers to be able to fly aircraft in a manner that creates operational capacity. And then secondarily, we have the opportunity to coexist at Grand Forks Air Force Base, which went through a BRAC round several years ago, and they divested the bomber ramp, the old B-52 ramp. And that is now an industry-run area. The folks that I work for, Grand Sky, they run that facility in an enhanced use lease agreement with the United States Air Force. But one of the things that they have there is two core tenants, Northrop Grumman and General Atomics. And they are operating on a daily basis MQ-9s beyond visual line of sight without any chase aircraft using a ground-based sense and avoid system that was put in place and granted a waiver under 91.113, which allows those aircraft to operate without any chase planes. So we already had the architecture, right? So that core competency already existed inside of that little microcosm of Grand Forks County to be able to do this. So what we did was just say, instead of using Group 5 drones, we're going to be using groups 1s, 2s, and 3s, right? Mostly group 3s because the military is really interested in logistics, and group 3s go from 320 to 1,300 pounds. And so that's what we're principally focused on. And so, again, the early stages of this was all the simulation work to develop the traffic management schemes and all of the approval authorities and test and evaluate the concept. And then last year in task order 2, we actually put a group 3 drone into the airspace, flew it out of the Delta underneath the TFR. The TFR was not active, but it is there, so we had to deconflict with it. But we flew from Delta into Echo, squawking, talking, and doing everything 60 nautical miles, well beyond visual line of sight, to Cavalier Space Force Station, landed and dropped off payload, reloaded and flew back the exact same way. And we did that 10 times last year. This year, we're doing it 52 times. With a much more robust payload capacity, starting off somewhere around 45 pounds and ending notionally somewhere around 100 pounds.
Now, Chris, you've made the case that the Department of War is going to really lead the charge for airspace integration. And what does the military maybe understand about that, that the commercial market is missing?
I think it's the interoperability. So realistically speaking, the commercial industry has been more critical, I think, for obvious reasons, of the Federal Aviation Administration, the speed of advance that they've been able to apply this technology for. The Department of War has a different take on things, which is we need to interoperate, always have interoperated with the Federal Aviation Administration. So how do we find common ground, something that benefits the Department of Transportation that also benefits the Department of War when we're talking about the national airspace system of the United States of America? That's the first thing. The second thing is that I think the military has always been, as you and I both know, being military aviators, a go along to get along inside the NAS kind of organization. We have not asked the FAA in any way, shape, or form, nor have we ever suggested to them that they need to change the way they do business in order to adopt some new methodology that the military wants to do. We conform to commercial aviation rules, and I know we do things differently when needed to, but this is full transparent integration and coordination with the FAA. And I think that's the slight nuance that I would say is a little bit different, where industry is looking for the FAA to approve things. I think the Department of War is looking to say, hey, the way we do things, let's go ahead and figure out how we implement those policies as is and make it work, which is principally what we've been doing. Knocking down some of the barriers, yes, when there's institutional inertias, and we can highlight that for both agencies to say, hey, this is kind of ridiculous. Is there a reason why there needs to be a 90-day lead time for this or that? But we're being very methodical about it. So I think from that perspective, it's making the FAA very, very happy, because we're taking baby steps, incremental steps, backing it up with the data that we're going to talk about, and then putting together not the business case, but the safety case of why we can do it. And that is how we're leading the charge, with safety cases, not business cases. And I think that's the subtle difference.
Yeah, well, I think the safety case for, you know, adoption, you know, more widespread is going to be critical. And what are the, you know, as you see this this adoption, what's going to facilitate it? Where are the bottlenecks? Is it DOT, Congress, FAA, industry? What are some of the areas we need to really be thinking about?
I think the bottleneck is in everybody's understanding of how these things are going to integrate, right? So if you take a look at the traditional pathway that's happened from a Department of Transportation perspective, is everybody's looked at this like it's a community-based traffic management problem to solve. And I've stated before, I'm not trying to poke anybody in the eye, that this is not what I think is community-based traffic management. Community-based traffic management, when people say that to me, I think the Hurricane Katrina effort that we went through. I was one of the few helicopters, not few, many helicopter crews that were in Hurricane Katrina from the start. And by the end, without any air traffic controllers there, it was a hornet's nest of helicopters trying to rescue people and do the job. But it was exceedingly dangerous and very, very difficult. And that is not even close to the scale of aircraft that we're talking about for full integration of unmanned systems. So how can we expect everything in a community-based traffic management format to just see and avoid everything else? There is some statements that have been made.
Well, you know, you got a good point, though. Now think about, like, maybe there's 100, 200, 300 helicopters, but now eventually, let's say in an urban area, you could have thousands, tens of thousands of drone flights in a given 24-hour period, and all that has to integrate in then with, you know, general aviation and commercial aviation and military aviation. And that helicopter that gets dispatched on an emergency, and they got to create a safety corridor for this air, you know, this helicopter to life flight out to this highway and back to bring a, you know, an injured person.
Yeah, and the mainstay of community-based traffic management is self-awareness, right? Detect and avoid.
Yep.
I just don't know that that technology is going to exist anytime soon. So how do we change the paradigm and start working with the technology that we do have to facilitate the integration now? And then as the new technology becomes more robust, we then evolve the concept, right? So it's just creating awareness for everybody and then following the rules. Then I think there's also a paradigm shift right? Manufacturing needs to be able to change. And we saw this with the, you know, the Secretary of War coming out and basically canceling JSIDs and changing the whole procurement process. If we're going to start moving towards unmanned aviation, as much as that makes pilots like you and I cringe a little bit, right? But there's a certain shift in the metrics associated with safety cases when it comes to producing aircraft, when it's an airworthiness situation that just prohibits the aircraft from falling out of the sky, or if it is falling out of the sky, at least can it avoid things that it's going to hit on the ground. That's completely different than what it's like to actually have passengers in the back of something, right? So if the only thing that we're going to lose is a few packages, that's a very different safety case than flying around our families.
Correct.
So yep. Those are some of the conversations that we're having that the Department of War is, they're making the statement, they're saying, of course, that makes sense, right? And the FAA is now saying, okay, great, awesome. I'm glad you agree with me. So let's move forward in that regard.
So to build on that, you know, you guys are flying missions that are both transiting, as you talked about, military airspace, commercial airspace, back into military airspace. What are some of the, biggest operational challenges you guys had to overcome as you're starting to actually run real BV loss missions in the national aerospace system?
Yeah, so I'll give you two examples, and these to me are they highlight, I think, the willingness for the Federal Aviation Administration in working in partnership with the Department of War to find solutions. The first time that we went to do a flight from Grand Forks Air Force Base proper to Cavalier Space Force Station in the NAS, right? Squawking and talking. We're not talking out in the middle of nowhere where anybody can do it. We ran into a problem because there's a certain transmit requirement, frequency requirement, and approval from FCC and NTIA because we were using a Navy-owned aircraft that had a transponder in it that wasn't authorized to transmit in the Grand Forks area because there's specific geographic locations where you can do that. I'm not kidding you when I say that 48 hours before we were supposed to do flight operations, we still did not have approval from NTIA and FCC, and we were working through the process with the FAA and the Department of War where phone calls had to be made at a very senior level to unhinge a process where two people in, I'm not going to say what building they were in, but they were in the basement of the building in two different shops, basically saying this, I'll sign it when he signs it because I'm not signing it first. Approval for that particular license.
They're in CYA mode, weren't they?
Yes. So totally understand everybody doesn't want to be the person to step out on that limb, but there had to be several phone calls made to knock down that institutional inertia in order for us to be able to fly. And it was very successful and we had a good flight operation. Now we're starting to realize there's other problems. Think about it from this perspective. Your VFR weathermans. Your VFR weathermans are based on see and avoid. Cloud clearances, and for you to be able to see and avoid other aircraft. That is completely ridiculous for an aircraft that does not have a pilot in it, nor does it have a forward-facing camera requirement. So when I fly beyond visual line of sight with a drone, what should my cloud clearances be, and what should be my weather minimums? So without saying, because what we don't want to do is try and say this aircraft is doing an IFR flight, because that is a completely, if I'm taking it and I'm putting it into instrument flight rules, that is completely different utilization of the NAS. So we have authorization for the first time from the Federal Aviation Administration to operate under our test, clear of clouds with 1 mile of visibility at the departure and arrival site with no weather minimums en route.
And how does that compare to people that are familiar to like special VFR clearance for a helicopter?
So what it does, I mean, it's actually even creates better minimums than special VFR because special VFR is 501, right? So
yep.
That means that technically, you know, nobody else is flying out there, which is ironic. I was talking to one of my colleagues. I was sitting there and it was 1,000 overcast, but 1 mile of viz. Okay. And that was because of the Canadian wildfires. I can see for a mile. So a visual observer can see the aircraft. I have an electronic observer for en route, which radar doesn't stop because of smoke. So I could not fly that day. I literally could not launch my Group 3 drone to go from point A to point B. Why? That makes no sense. Nobody else is flying. There is nobody else flying VFR flights around. If they're flying, they're flying on an IFR flight plan because it's not 1003. So this is actually the golden opportunity to be able to fly a Group 3 drone. So now I have that restriction eased. It's a 91155, which is VFR Weatherman's for a Group 3 drone just for this test person. But that's going to give information back to the FAA to be able to go back to the policy office and have a conversation about what we can do and what we can't do with these drones. It seems ridiculous to me that we're not flying when pretty much all of general aviation is not flying either.
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of talk, too, about different aircraft platforms, you know, Group 1 through 5, all the different drone platforms. So what do you think is going to facilitate the scaling? Is it going to be better hardware, software, technology on the platforms themselves? Or is it this infrastructure, air traffic management, weather, that part of it?
Yeah. So one of the drones we're looking at right now that we're starting to work with is phenomenal. And it's an incredible Group 3 drone, but right now it's at the lower end of that weight, right? So when it's fully maxed out, it's only 330 pounds. So it could go up another 1,000 pounds, which means that, you know, we could scale this thing up and start carrying some pretty significant weight on it. Now, there would have to be a more robust engine, right? And probably a little bit better battery technology. But again, size, weight, and power, these drones are incredible in their thrust to weight, mm-hmm. their scalability and maneuverability. All of these things are incredible opportunities for us to start experimenting with them. And they're so low cost that when you need to make a modification in the production line in order to accommodate some kind of new technology or new capability, it's very, very easy to do without going into a massive amount of changes in your production and therefore your certification process. So what I see is the potential future for this. And some of the things that we did, I mean, we actually transported blood during our last go around under a temperature controlled, right? So the only thing, we could not get some of the research data that we wanted because we hadn't gone through our IRB, our review board process, fast enough. So, you know, we weren't allowed to use the data to publish. But these are opportunities for us to do new and unique things with drones on behalf of Department of War, with FAA sitting right in our corner to watch and provide that safety and oversight such that they can take the information back and apply it where it needs to be applied in order to open the airspace up to the integration of drones.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the Aerospace System Integration Service, right? And maybe you can kind of educate some of the people. There's a lot that goes into that. We have data from sensors, radar, whether it's ADS-B, we have data coming from the aircraft itself, change direction. How does that inform making real-time, you know, flight operation decisions as something's, you know, flying?
Right. So at its core, what we built, the airspace integration system, is basically mirroring the federal USSs, UAS service suppliers. They have a discovery and synchronization server. They have authentication servers to make sure that there's not people in the network who shouldn't be in the network. They have flight management systems. But then they have a tremendous amount of data storage and data integration, right? And so it's basically three servers that communicate together. And then anybody, air navigation service providers, supplemental data service providers, UAS operators, they can all tie into that network and it feeds the information and it disseminates it where it needs to be. Weather services, you take your pick. So we work with all of them, and there are federally based ones and there are commercially based ones. And right now, to your point that you were making earlier about the data, that's the most important part, which is exchanging information across all of these networks and figuring out what the architecture needs to look like and what the requirements are so that the sheriff's department knows who's in the air, who's supposed to be there, who's not supposed to be there. The base commander who's operating a base next to an area that has a Class B airport where TSA is concerned about the airport. just think about what the federal restricted zone looks like and all of the various bases and all the various different operations around Washington, D.C. that operate together with aviation. How do you include drones into all of that and make it safe, secure, and the data is exchanging between all of them and nobody's capable of hacking into it and causing a problem? So these are the things that we're starting to articulate for the federal government, for the Department of Transportation, for the Department of War, and for Department of Homeland Security. Even Department of Energy is involved in what we do because there is some critical infrastructure that requires protection. You know, all of our nuclear reactors, all the things that you would traditionally say are Department of Energy owned, right? The power and distribution networks. Those all have requirements under U.S. code to defend them against nefarious actors. So this becomes an airspace management picture more than anything else, because if I was to liken it to finding a needle in a haystack, which we're looking for the one nefarious actor, we're not even saying the person who is clueless and careless, right? Those people can usually be dealt with pretty easy. We're talking about a person who really wants to do something wrong, okay? How do I remove all the hay so that when the haystack's gone, there's nothing left but needles for us to evaluate? That's the process that we're trying to figure out right now. And we're working with every single one of the members of the interagency through this process to provide the interactive compatibility to share data and operate in the airspace and make sure everybody is keenly aware of what's happening.
How far away are we from that level of interoperability?
So we are going to start testing here, I think next month, possibly the month after that, a new system that's coming out of the Office of Secretary of Transportation for Research called MNAP. MNAP is a mobile network aviation architecture, and it's a program that basically provides basically an app to every general aviationist who wants to be a part of the process. You would have an app on your cell phone that communicates with every cell tower that you're flying around to basically say, here I am. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of electronic conspicuity. Electronic conspicuity
I have not heard the word, but I like the word, but go ahead.
Yeah, electronic conspicuity is literally being conspicuous.
Okay.
It's not being inconspicuous, but it's electronically saying, here I am. So if you are on a cell phone, essentially on this program, on the app, you would be letting the app know where you are, and by extension, the operator of NNAP, which is Secretary of Transportation in this process. There's also a low, it's like 500 gram size, weight, and power, low draw, like 3 amps. System that you could put into any drone, group one up through group five, that does the same thing. So effectively, if every general aviationist was operating with MNAP and every drone and commercial aircraft had MNAP in it, we would effectively remove all the hay from the haystack.
Couldn't I, fly as if I want to be conspicuous until I didn't want to be? And then...
What, switch it off?
Yeah.
Yeah, so then
should highlight something, right? If I'm looking at things real time, all of a sudden, the system records a state change. You're like, oh, I got to flag that.
Exactly. So then you become inconspicuous. You're not conspicuous, right? And so that's the thing that we're interested in, is what's being seen by our other sensors that's not being seen by a system like MNAP, right? So this is the same thing. Concept-wise, is having a transponder on-off, right? So you're squawking. When you stop squawking, and you're still a radar image, so your primary radar, but now your secondary radar is not coming in, you're now really interesting to somebody in the FAA.
Yeah.
So you're a target, but you're not squawking. And if you're in Class A airspace, you're who?
Well, if you're in Class A airspace and do that, you're a problem.
Exactly.
Or so, potentially a problem, but I need to ascertain that very quickly.
Yes. So that's where thresholds come in, is we're starting to work through this with, TSA, And the Department of Homeland Security, the guys at JIATF 401 who are responsible for the interagency collaboration around counter UAS. Again, the response in Ultra is the counter UAS side of the house. So we have an entire team of people working with the interagency on the counter UAS aspects of it, because for us, it's an airspace management issue. It doesn't matter whether you're good for the airspace or bad for the airspace. To us, you're just, that's categorically where you get racked and stacked.
Yeah, and now Project Ultra is primarily or solely focused on cargo missions?
No, it's not primarily focused on cargo missions at all. It's
oh, good. Yeah, so share some more, because I was going to ask you, because I thought it was mostly cargo. And what's the biggest value in addition to what we're talking about here, but just that mission set provides the DOW? But I'd love for you to share more on that.
Yeah. So again, we have we've been working with the acquisitions and sustainment side of the house. We also work with the R&E side of OUSW, so the research and engineering side of the house. We work with COCOMs. We've been doing work with CENTCOM. We work with DARPA, DIU, and we work with some of the downrange capability that the United States military brings back and says, "Hey, look, how do we merge realities here between what the capability is behind some of these Group 3 drones and what they could do in the military environment? And how do we, in a very crawl, walk, run methodology, implement that test and evaluation operationally here in the United States of America, graduate it to where an operator could operate it, so say from the other side of the country or perhaps from a downrange facility, but the aircraft is flying here in CONUS, so that they could practice new TTPs, techniques, tactics, procedures, SOPs, okay, things like, yep, that, validate them, and then implement them in the battle space.
With all of that said, what are some of the key use cases that you see the DOW using coming out of this?
Well, I think, okay, so it's an airborne asset, right? So there's always going to be ISR. Right. So intelligence, right, surveillance and reconnaissance will be the omnipresent issue. I think there's payload delivery. I think there's battle space resupply. I think there's medevac. The biggest thing, actually, when I start thinking about this from a Department of War perspective, minus what we're doing right now in theater, but the omnipresent mission is humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. I think that is probably going to be one of the biggest things that Group 3 drones will play a factor in. Simply because every time one of those events happens, pick the ring of fire, pick anywhere you want on the planet, and the U.S. military responds, it's how fast can you get stuff from point A to point B. And when you can do that at scale with thousands of drones that are capable of carrying hundreds of pounds, that's a game changer.
Yeah, and you can probably make that autonomous, right? Like here's the lat long of, I need you to land within 2 meters of that and just go land, let somebody unload you, and then just you keep firing them out. Or you could actually have them land in a series.
Yeah, it's Connex boxes of drones showing up. I mean, use this, the droid army from Star Wars as a euphemism, but that's no kidding what it could be. They just start pouring out and picking things up and going places to provide relief to the people who need it.
And that one there directly relates to the commercial application. What other commercial applications do you see coming out of this? Especially once, let's say, BV loss is approved. Let's just say 108's now live and, we can now do this.
Well, so I'm going to be bold and say that 108 is a stepping stone to what the future is going to be. So if you have an aircraft that's type model series certified that can actually fly beyond visual line of sight, managing the airspace the way every other aircraft manages the airspace. And I'm saying that very intentionally, right? So you're squawking, talking, you've got ADS-B, you're doing all of those things. Why do you need 108? 108 is for people who can't comply with Part 91. So if you can comply with Part 91, you now have a different set of rules, right? And you're just going from point A to point B, and that's logistics missions 101.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's where things are. It's going to be a real game changer. So there are some things that we're starting to do for the Department of War that I think the Department of Transportation is very interested in, because if we get them done for the DOW in the NAS, it's going to be a foregone conclusion for things. So as an example, if you could some point get to the position where for a training mission, you could launch from point A and go to point B in the NAS with live ordnance on the bottom of a Group 3 drone, what does hazmat really mean anymore?
Some interesting questions, isn't there?
Yeah, it's the logical extension of, if we're doing this, why wouldn't we be able to do that, which is much less dangerous?
Well, and Chris, you have talked about the shift from research to operational capability. What is something that, you know, operationalizing this is that a lot of the companies out there that are manufacturing drones, reselling drones, are underestimating?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the C2 systems are need to have more of a common operating thread, right?
Everybody's command and control, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So the command and control side of the house is everybody wants to kind of figure out what that looks like. But I don't think that the new construct, as you mentioned, the way forward. I've got some big competitors out there, and I'm trying not to mention names because, you know, that always creates some kind of issue. But you've got, you know, who the big shipping competitors are. In order for them to get a return on investment, to your point, is how many drones is a return on investment for you? Is it 1,000? Is it 10,000? Well, if there's four competitors, now I've got 40,000 drones. What's the C2 architecture for 40,000 drones look like? What does command and control really mean? Right? So people are building architecture, and a lot of it doesn't have any commonality to it because what they're trying to do is create demand signal, right? So buy my system, and it's got its own C2 capability. Well, I think it would be a little bit better for all of us, because I'm agnostic to it. I could care less. I just want the technology to work. If there was one common platform that was a C2 system that could fly everything.
Do you think something, you know, you remember back when we were kids, the VHS and beta debate, and VHS won out?
Yeah.
Do you think there's going to be something similar here, where there's going to be one standard, this is interoperability across this whole ecostructure that everybody's going to have to either use it or you don't get to fly?
Yeah, so take a look at it this way, right? So I've said this before, because there have been so many people since this started, since the Federal Modernization Reform Act, who have pushed the bounds of technology, and I think that's awesome. It's wonderful. We're here because of them. But there's a little bit of a confluence or like conflation between business case and technology case. And the business case seems to work out when people or win out. I shouldn't say work out, because it doesn't work out. It's the antithesis. People tend to push the limits by saying, I've got to be the first to market. First to market wins. And my statement to that is you can convince me that when you take out your BlackBerry and type it to me. What drones and the interaction of drones in the United States of America will look like is not what it is today. It will look like something completely different, because these things don't look like BlackBerries.
Nope.
At all.
Mm-mm.
They all look alike. You can't tell what somebody's holding. They all look very, very much the same, but there are four or five different of them, but they all look pretty much the same.
You know, it was funny, Chris, I was down in Mexico recently, and there's signs there that say no cell phones with a red line, but this picture of the cell phone is a BlackBerry. And
yeah.
I was there with my friend's son, and I said, hey, what is that? He goes, I don't know. Is that some kind of like old ancient phone or something? He had no idea what that was. And, that, you know,
yeah.
15 years ago, BlackBerry was like the thing.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was absolutely
it's kind
it.
Of funny. I mean, I hadn't seen a picture of a BlackBerry until last week, and I don't know how long. So,
yeah, you can tell when you're watching. So like I've been binge watching one show, right? And just reruns. I never watched it ever, but it's a show from the late 90s, early 2000s, right? And I've been watching it. It's like 8 seasons. And everybody in the show has got either, you know, these goofy flip phones or BlackBerries or this, that, and the other. And I'm just sitting there, like, taking a trip down memory lane of what technology used to look like. But it was just yesterday, right? It wasn't that long ago.
No. Hey, question for you. So North Dakota, as you described it, we have an office up there, amazing people, very unique environment, though. So with what you're doing there, which is really special, then what does it take to take what you're doing with Ultra and scale that nationally or globally?
Oh, yeah. No, great question, because that's one of the core tenets of Project Ultra for the Department of War, is that we need to be sustainable, repeatable, and scalable, right? So everything that we do is with an eye towards when we are going to, for the Department of War, scale this throughout the enterprise. So we're already starting to, so our initial BB loss corridor, 60 nautical miles in a wedge that basically goes in, like I'm using euphemistic cardinal headings here, but goes from, you know, like 270 to 360, right? So due west to due north out of Grand Forks Air Force Base. We're already starting to change that wedge to incorporate opportunities to fly down to the restricted ranges over Camp Grafton South. We're already starting to have conversations about what it looks like to extend our corridor out to Camp Grafton North, which is over Devil's Lake. Okay. And then what it looks like to create a trans-state corridor that connects Minot Air Force Base to Grand Forks Air Force Base with, you know, the Air Force Global Strike Command out there. So what does that look like to create these multi-corridors of activity where we're flying not only logistics missions, but some of the other training missions and things that the Department of War wants to do? And how do we do that in partnership with our friends in the other agencies? So Customs and Border Protection, Department of Homeland Security, Coast Guard. There's a lot of people who have interest in what this could be, because as soon as we start unlocking those keys to expanding the airspace, realize where we are in Grand Forks, just south of the Canadian border. So can we create a transnational route? I mean, these are all the things that are going to get us the data that we're talking about that are going to allow us to start moving in directions that I think are going to be game changers for implementing unmanned systems.
Well, and I think another area too is just the potential of what drone as a first responder could be for public safety and so many different, you know, areas of that, though, that could be just a huge growth area.
Right, right. So I think this is a golden opportunity for us, and we are ubiquitous to the technology. We want more people coming up. Now, I caution, because I say that and the door starts busting open and people start running in, but we're putting stuff in front of the acquisitions community inside of the Department of War, and we're telling the truth.
Yep.
Okay, and I say that very intentionally, because there are a lot of salespeople out there, business development-wise, who would love to tell you that they're a technical readiness 3. Or sorry, the technical readiness 8 when they're actually at 3.
Right.
Right. I've had many a conversation that saying, you know, like, okay, where are you guys actually flying? And it turns out they're flying in their mom's basement. Right. And that's not what I would call TRL 8.
On a MacBook Mini.
Yeah.
Let's kind of land with this one here. I want to ask you a question, because you guys are working across government and infrastructure and operators, and you're creating this system. How do you see, let's say, investment firms, OEMs, ecosystem builders plugging into what you're creating up there with Project Ultra?
So great question. We have to be very, very careful about that particular statement. We're working on behalf of the Department of War, right? So at the end of the day, every ounce of technology that comes in is welcome. But it goes through a process where we don't just ingest and say yes to everybody. We politely take everybody's input, and then we funnel it up to the Office of Undersecretary of War for Acquisitions. And they take a look at it, and they take a look at the companies. There's a lot of rigor that goes into the parts lists for, you know, the ETP process, exemption to policy, to make sure these are blue UAS or blue equipment, that we're not touching any technology that's covered. And that there's a full background check on the manufacturing and capability of the company and the ownership of the company. So again, from an industry perspective, there's sometimes a little Heisman Trophy action that ends up happening until somebody can adjust their manufacturing or adjust their parts list in order to be subsumed into a federal program. So from that perspective, we're not as agile as some of the industry partners can be, because they don't have to adhere to the federal process of covered technology. We do have to adhere to the covered technology process. And so that slows us down on the front end. But then on the back end, we get to speed up where other people don't, because we have the full weight of the Federal Aviation Administration working in partnership with the Department of War. So I have more access to airspace than most people do.
Yeah. Great answer. Man, this has been awesome. We need to have you back on, Chris. There's so many things that are happening with what you're doing and updates. But just as we wrap up, what final words would you like to leave to everybody who's been listening in?
Yeah, no. First of all, we cannot do this without a community of people who are all bent on the same thing, which is the safe integration of unmanned systems into the NAS. So I will say that Project Ultra has been leading the way, in my opinion, for the safe integration of unmanned systems. In other words, we're not taking risks without the proper mitigation strategy. And that harkens back to our naval aviation past, which is, yes, I have a NATOPS, that golden book that tells me all the things that I can and cannot do. And when I don't have an appropriate response out of NATOPS, it's up to me to use sound judgment. We are using sound judgment, but we're also using years and years of aviation experience, not just in the operator's world, but also in the engineering world, in the air traffic management world. There are hundreds of people with a tremendous amount of background that are pouring themselves into this from various different agencies to provide the oversight that is allowing us to do this. I don't want people to think that we're out there cowboying, because we're not. What we're doing is methodically demonstrating capacity and capability. And after we do, then we're going back to the drawing board and then demonstrating scalability and repeatability and sustainability. And once we can do those things, that's going to allow people to move into the policy world and say, we can write this now. It makes sense. Instead of somebody doing a one-off flight, a demonstrator event does not prove safety. We're not a demonstration event. We are an operational test world. We balance on the knife's edge between implementation and research every day. And that's the most important part for us, which is the safety side of the house.
That's awesome. And I can hear the passion for that in your voice, and I share it. And man, I appreciate that. So, Chris, keep knocking them alive out there. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to our next conversation since we're both here in town together.
Yes, sir. Looking forward to it.